dream before I came here that I was required to do some light carpentry when I got here. And I remember saying over the phone, well, okay. But it is a delight to be here, and I want to thank the VCU English Department and the Levis family, which is one family, I can see. And it is a great honor to be here where I went to school. And it's funny, I think I might have had a physics class in here. And I think if my teacher came in, she would probably see me up here and go, that's about right, you know. And my father grew up here, and I think, though I've never asked, I think I was conceived on Grove Avenue somewhere. So it's great to be here. And I'm going to read, to begin with, a poem. Actually, I was thinking when I was putting this reading together what I might do, and I noticed that I have a real jones to read love poems. And I'm usually militantly brief when I read, and I will be brief, but I noticed that I kind of want to read the whole book. I'm not going to do that. I want to read until slowly each of you file out, and my mother and father are sleeping right there. And my mom and dad are here, and I'm happy to have them here. But I will be brief. This first poem is about, and I've read this poem a number of times in this city, and I hope no one is tired of it, but I do like to read it. Say you're sitting in a restaurant and you're eavesdropping, partly because you can't help it, and you hear a lot. And so that by the end of the conversation, you feel like you need to get up and introduce yourself. But it's called 10-letter word for a lucky man. Jimmy Toombs, you have the best name in the county, as far as I'm concerned. And the woman I overheard today, in the way she said your name softly, combining your first and last name into one sound. And she was in the booth behind me at Fran's place. And Jimmy Toombs, she said, and Jimmy Toombs, Jimmy Toombs, Jimmy Toombs, for an hour going on about your private business. And I thought, there is no finer thing ever to happen in a man's life but to have a woman fall in love with you and for her to sweetly tell her friend your name over and over in a public place. And that, Jimmy Toombs, truly makes you the luckiest man with the best-sounding name in the whole green state of Virginia. And her friend was quiet as your friend spoke, and spoons lightly touched the sides of coffee cups being stirred all over the restaurant. And when the waitress came over to clear a dish or ask a question of the woman who loves Jimmy Toombs and the friend of the woman who loves Jimmy Toombs, their conversation stopped momentarily, and I went back to Zippy the Pinhead in the crossword puzzle in the Washington Post. But it was impossible, Jimmy Toombs. And when my slice of pie came with whipped cream, the waitress carried two other small blue plates in her left hand, and I listened, Jimmy Toombs, when she said, his kiss is like a feather. And we ate pecan pie, the three of us, quietly, all together. That's my child, by the way, who's been making the noise. And what a terrible dad. I went up and told her to take the baby outside. I'm sorry. Oh, my God. Bad parenting right from the start here. Okay. This poem here, I wrote it for my sister, Lisa, who is here tonight, who's never heard me read before, and I thank her for coming. And she runs marathons, and that just is amazing to me that people run marathons. And I know a lot of people do. But the amazing thing about it seems is that you spend all that time getting ready to run a marathon, you know, which means when you're not running one, you're running half of one. And I drive 26 miles and I go, hey, look at me, you know. I mean, I'm not like that. So it's stunning to me that she does this. So I was thinking about, how do you finish a marathon? I know you're dead tired and you're done with it, but like when you're roller skating and you're done roller skating, you still roller skate, you know, your legs are still moving that way. How do you sleep? You know, what are you dreaming about? What happens? And I, when thinking of that, it reminded me a bit of what she must feel laying in bed after a marathon is a little like what a poet feels like sitting at the table, I think. There is something running over and over, and it's a musical, and it has a cadence and a rhythm, and you can't let go of it. This is called The 27th Mile of a Marathon for Lisa. The runner picks up speed and lifts off gently from the blue slope of Earth's wide curve. and oceans pass beneath her, craggy shorelines, the patchwork atlas of forest and field, the lush dark of the world asleep. The runner dreams. Tell me, she says to stillness, tell me a story of speed and tell it to me fast, for the light is gaining and I will wake, and with this body break the barrier between what I dream and what my dreaming means. My sister sleeps. The runner lifts off gently from the blue slope of Earth's curve, from the ordinary pacing of her ordinary feet, and goes speeding through the night as the world whirs past, a blur of trees, houses, and streets. The runner dreams. Tell me, she says to speed, tell me a story of stillness, and tell it to me slow, for I don't have far to go before the sleeping body's dreaming stops, and having nowhere to go, this joyfulness might also go. So tell it slow. My sister sleeps. The runner speeds into the stillness of dream and lifts off gently from the blue slope of Earth's wide curve. And what she knows of stillness is what she knows of speed. And all she knows of dream is stillness and speed. The runner dreams. I'm going to read something that I wrote when I heard that Larry Levis had died. And I think that it is mostly the response to a lost love, which is an elegy. You know, I mean, it's like a death at times. But when I wrote this poem for him, really, when I was writing this book, it was before I'd written many of the poems in here, and writing the poem, I don't think it's necessarily typical of many of the poems in here, but it opened a door to something, to so many of the poems in this book. It provided me a way of coming at subject matter or that I didn't have before. And I feel a little embarrassed that I still can't articulate what it is that happened, but it did, and it started with this poem, and I'll read it now for Larry Levis. It's called The Sublime. Excuse me, but it also reminds me of, I think all writers, and I know there are a lot of writers here too, but I'm just emerging from a time where you think, what is the point? Why am I doing this? Why write? You know, it's a question that every 10 years knocks me on my ass, and it has, and I'm getting up now. But I think when I wrote this poem helped me get out of there, stand back up. I think that's what I'm trying to say. The sublime. And what good is a dream, finally? It breaks your head open, and cello music pours out of a stranger's window. And the most gorgeous woman you ever loved says to hit the road, and you do see them, that stranger and this woman, kissing everywhere, in the trees, on boats, in the kitchen cupboards. The fog of daily life never lifts, and the checkbook needs proper calculations, and the dog would like supper, please, and now, without warning, the dream returns. It breaks your head open. You lie there for a week, and no one finds you until the dog, having lost its dignity, finally eats. And when there is no more, it howls. And you are a missing person. A passage of shit quivered into the dirt. A good boy. A terrible dream someone picks up with a plastic bag wrapped in his hand to throw away. And you are thrown away. You do it every day. Waking too early. Driving to work. Working and returning. Reading poems of great beauty and crying at the movies. Touching the hair of your niece who laughs at water. Flying over cornfields so close and so openly that when you wake, there is silk in your beard. Your arms are tired and hang at your sides like the wings of a migratory bird who is about to die. And what good is a dream, finally? It breaks your heart, and you stand in the lush dark of the moment after twilight ends and begin to sing, and nothing makes sense to you. And you sing louder for a while, then awkwardly sit down where you are. And the stars overhead, they shine a little, no more or less than usual. And whether it is daylight and they are invisible, or whether it is night and they are the embers of a blacksmith's fire, they shine, and you are grateful that love is like a hammer. I think, too, that this book is about, I've said it before, is about sex and death, it seems to me, which is another way of saying, you know, blessing and loss, or And ordinarily, I do read a lot of the sadder poems, but I think there is, I think, when often when the poems are joyful, there is this celebration of dream. And I think saying that I wanted to read love poems, I think those are the ones, too, I wanted to read, the ones that celebrate dream and that signal possibility to me as a writer. But I think I always return to dream. I always return to that moment right where you, before you've fallen asleep, and you're not awake and you're not asleep, and the world is unmoored. That to me is where it begins. When I can retain that feeling through the day, not just when I'm sitting at my desk, which makes for a bad driver, but but there is that you have to, I think, a writer needs to cultivate, not just when you're sitting at your desk, but at all times. And this is called, "If Every Night You Sleep, You Die." A friend of mine requested this, and I'm glad she did. "A house comes over the mountain singing the blues, and the ghost of Robert Johnson hollers, and the ghost of his guitar lies in the back of the dark, supercharged blue Cadillac. He swerves as he guns to the right of the house coming over the mountain too fast, much too fast. And a rocket whispers by this young man heading back to Mississippi. And the rocket zooming wobbles as it goes, and Joseph and Mary laugh while the baby Jesus combs his black pompadour with one hand on the controls. And maybe every time you sleep, you die, and a magnet at the very center of the universe pulls the house over the mountain. And the mountain follows, and the void of space fills with objects as lakes and possums arc over nothing and join the moon, and all the paintings of Willem de Kooning spin ferocious alongside carburetors and refrigerators from junkyards. And the salad fork of a once great restaurant glimmers in the passing light of the passing sun, gone with the death-stained, elegant dress Audrey Hepburn was buried in. And 1,000 dogs chasing one cat bark and bark as the jungle of Costa Rica floats by like a planet. In the Garden of Eden, with Adam and Eve holding on tightly to the frail bowed end of a young willow tree, goes by your house like a flying saucer, and sausage on a grill sizzles still, heading onward. And a young woman out sweeping the parking lot of a 7-Eleven laughs as the broom leaps from her small, startled hands." I've been a part of a few English departments as a student and as a teacher and as a visitor of sorts. And I've been struck, the longer I have been away from here, about how not only are the faculty of the English department here devoted to their subject, but truly devoted to their students. I'm constantly overwhelmed with this increases as I get older, which is lucky, but I'm amazed at the generosity at the time of dealing with a kid who didn't know what he was doing, but was doing it. And all the things that were given to me by a whole variety of teachers that I didn't know I needed or mattered until later. That means a lot to me. And this poem is partly for that love, I think, that the teachers here have had for their, and have for their students, I guarantee. But I think there's a tradition of poets writing poems to their high school English teachers. And I know Henry Taylor has, that's tradition. I'm from his county too. We didn't have the same teachers, but. So anyway, I wrote this poem for an amalgam of a couple different high school English teachers. It's called, "Here the Street is Narrow." I think this is as a kind of love poem. And so when he sees his high school English teacher walk toward him on the sidewalk, 15 years after undressing her, invisibly, nimbly, during hours of Julius Caesar, he says, "Hello there, sweet tits." And she slaps him so hard his glasses fly and break. His cheek stings, and her hand stings even more, and he apologizes. And they stand there together, awkward, and neither says a word for about 3 seconds. And she bends to help him gather the lenses and wire. But what actually happened, no one believes. It was sunny like a postcard of the Virgin Islands, but late October, in the mix of orange and green leaves on the sugar maples lining the street, glowed incandescent. And she didn't slap him. and the sugar maples glowed incandescent still in the sunny, crystalline blue day of this late October afternoon. And they smiled and talked, and he confessed charmingly to the high school crush and how often he undressed her, and she told of feeling a draft often in that classroom. And they went to a hotel room in the next town over and made love slowly all day, and that was it. She never called him back or returned his letters. And when she saw him on the sidewalk, as often she did in this small town, she said, "Hello there, cock of the walk," and laughed, and they were friendly, never talking or saying anything, but "Hello there, auburn hair, and hello, my sweet friend," whispering soft as they passed on the sidewalk under the sugar maples. I am actually waiting for a couple of high school English teachers to come up and slap me. Hasn't happened, but I think it might.